broadcasting worldwide on internet radio.
Refreshing takes on legal strategies.
Straightforward answers to difficult tax questions.
Independent ideas on building wealth. It's the Refresher Wealth Show with Mark Kohler and Matt Sorensen.
Get your free copy of Mark and Matt's ebooks and sign up for their weekly free newsletter with important tax deadlines and articles at refreshyourwealth.com.
Now, here's Mark and Matt.
Welcome, everyone, to the Refresh Your Wealth podcast with Matt Sorensen and Mark Kohler. This is Matt Sorensen here. Pretty amped to be with you today, I gotta say, after an amazing show last week where we were fielding all your tax and legal questions. Mark and I thought we should do an encore to last week's show, and because we did not get through, we barely made a dent in all the questions that we had, so we appreciate those that take the time to send them in. So, Mark, I mean, we're just going to keep hammering away at these questions you got. We know they're helpful to everyone else. We're trying to pull out the ones that we think will apply to most of you, the listeners. So,
yeah. And it's hard sometimes when we're trying to come up with a show dedicated entirely to one topic, and we try to get some special guests here and there. But just knocking out these base hits, just hitting them out of the park. I mean, Matt's right there in Phoenix, spring training. You know what I'm saying? Just hitting some base hits, right? I mean,
oh man, I went to a game last. Let's see. It was Friday. We took the office here. It was awesome. If you haven't been to a spring training baseball game, okay, guys, I'm not a baseball fan. Ever since Little League, I kind of got burnt out on it. It's boring to me. But live spring training is so awesome. You can hear like the sound of the bat on the ball. You're so close, and the stadiums aren't big. These are major league players. Plus, you hear like the snap of the mitt. I don't know why. It's all like about the sounds for me. And then, of course, there's the bratwurst and the hot dogs and all that, which is pretty special too. But it's just a cool experience. Whether it's Arizona or Florida, get there and go watch the spring training baseball game. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, well, we're all pretty jealous because yesterday it was snowing here at my office, and there are some blizzards across the country. So we really don't want to hear about this anymore.
Yeah, just that's call, the scrape of the shovel that you're hearing, right? The scrape
yeah,
of the shovel.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and I'll tell you, it's so quiet out there when it's snowing. It is surreal. I love it when it snows and I'm out at night and getting ready to shovel the driveway or whatever. But no, it is nice. But why don't you just check in with us when it's 120 degrees in Phoenix this summer, and then we'll all feel a little better about it. That's what we're doing.
I'm just gonna stay quiet then.
Well, okay, so I think this is a great follow-up to our last show. Again, we've titled this Answers to Common Tax and Legal Questions because we've got a lot of common questions here, and I think these are really helpful to a lot of our listeners. And we're just going to try to hit them quickly and easily. Now, I will say this. Please keep in mind that a lot of these Q&As are a good reminder that just doing a consultation for a half an hour or an hour once a year with your personal tax and legal advisor. Now, many of our listeners, they've got a tax and legal resource that is just perfect for them, and they love it. A lot of people don't fathom or realize that they can have access to a real tax lawyer, even just being a small business owner. And that's really the niche we've tried to build here. So we've got some good consultants, real live tax lawyers that just a half hour, an hour once a year can dial in your plan, give you a checklist to talk to your CPA. We have our accounting firm here too as a sister company if you need it. But hopefully a lot of these questions will either be a quick little resource for you or create a catalyst for you making a phone call and scheduling a consultation with your advisor or us. Either way, just get with someone once a year, having that third party review what you're doing. So that's what I think it's about, Matt.
Yeah, so we are nonetheless going to give you some free advice here, so take it for whatever it's worth. all right, well, you ready to fire away?
Yeah, and I think... Yeah, I thought you had a Coverdale question that was a good one. So we'll talk hard and fast, folks. This is it. Gonna have you have your yellow pad handy. Hopefully, we're gonna give you some great feedback. So go ahead, yeah. Matt.
And since this is the encore presentation of the Open Forum show, we got to give some. You know, you got to come back and play the hits when you do an encore. So let's see what we do here. All right. Well, this is from Michael from Portland. We'd been talking about in the last show about Coverdell IRAs, which are a great way. You can put $2,000 in per year, per student, per child, up to age 18. You can do this per year. But there's some issues on income on the person making the contribution, such as typically it's usually the parent making the contribution, but doesn't have to be. And so if you make, let's say, over $220,000 married, you're not even going to be able to contribute at all to a Coverdell for your child. But there's some ways around it that Mark mentioned on the show, Open Forum, last week, which was, Mark, I think you said, well, let's just gift the money to the grandparents and have the grandparents make the contribution. And Michael had a question about that, essentially how that works and how you can get around that income restriction and limitation.
Yeah, I think it's great. And so, in fact, there's other advisors out there that will even say gift the money to your child and let them open their own Coverdell. And so don't stress, folks, if you're high income earners, single, head of household, or married. The Coverdell is a great strategy to build wealth for college. I know the 529 plan's out there, people, but under the new Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, you can only withdraw only up to $10,000 a year out of a 529 now, which is just completely asinine, to be blunt. It's just the 529 is, in my opinion, pathetic as it is, and they just made it even worse. So it brings us back to what my favorite strategy is, the Coverdell. And some of you may say, well, $2,000 a year, Mark, isn't going to make a dent in my kid's college education. Well, that's where self-directing comes into play, people. This is, you can take that $2,000 and buy cryptocurrency. You could buy Super Bowl tickets and resell them for double the value every year. And pretty soon you start doubling that money every year and get started soon, you're going to have a nice little kitty for your kids when they need to go to college. And last point, the deadline to make your contribution for last year, 2017, is April 17th of 2018. So you can do $2,000 for last year per kid and drop in another $2,000 for this year, and there's $4,000 to work with. You got five kids, there's $20,000. Now you can form an LLC and go invest that $20,000 in a creative manner and maybe double it. Now you're making headway, people. So think outside the box, darn it. And you can't do that with a 529.
Yeah, 529, you're just, you know, you're just in the market, basically. That's it. You're in the market. So, but you know what I've seen, which I've always thought is cool in these Coverdells, is I see these with grandparents, parents who have got their own IRA in a deal. They get their kids' Coverdells in. Maybe they even have kids or grandkids' Roths in as well. And that's always really cool to see. I love seeing those creative deals put together. And a Coverdell is an excellent way to get a little money in and hopefully. And I've seen some of these accounts over $100,000 in them. And you know that's not the $2,000 a year they're putting in. They're getting good returns. So consider it for sure.
Okay, next question. This is from Ron. He says, I know you're only eligible for an HSA, health savings account, if you have a high deductible plan. My question is, what constitutes a high deductible? Now, before I answer Ron's question, let's point this out. This is another self-directing opportunity. You can invest your health savings account. It is not a use it or lose it plan. If you want to let that money ride and invest it from year to year and then use it for future medical, you can. And I was just talking to some friends over the weekend that had a child that needs a service animal, and they were going to buy a new dog for their child that has autism. And I was saying, that's a tax write-off. Your HSA can pay for all of it. And he's a doctor. And he was like, really? I can, you know, and he's all stoked on it. So the HSA is a wonderful medical savings account that acts like a Roth IRA, money in, money out. Now, here's the tax-free, and you get a tax deduction on the way in. So before we talk about the high deductible plan, which you have to have, the contribution limits for this year before April 17th, which still gets you a write-off for 2017, is $3,400 single, $6,750 family, and if you're between 55 and 65, you can put in an extra $1,000. So that's how much you can put in on the front page of your tax return, no AGI limits, take a tax write-off, and then Ron says, what constitutes a high-deductible plan so that I can play in this game? Mm-hmm. Well, a high-deductible plan is, let me give you those numbers here, is in 2017, it is $1,350 for an individual or $2,700 for a family. So you've got it. Now, there's a lot to a qualifying plan. There's a little bit more to that. So when you talk to your healthcare company, whether it's, let's say, for example, Blue Cross Blue Shield, you want to say, does this qualify as a high deductible plan? And then you're off to the races. So anyway, that's the HSA.
Okay, this was from Eddie. I thought this was a good question we missed last week. He says, what do you recommend for someone who has unfiled tax returns for 20 plus years? It says, I'm about to make a $225,000 annual salary, looks like this year. So back into making money, it sounds like, but it's had 20 years of unfiled tax returns. Let me give a couple thoughts, and we kind of, if you want to gather yours, Mark. But the first thing is what is the statute? This is statute, not statue. Statute of limitations for the IRS to collect. Generally, there's the worst case scenario is at 10 years that they have to collect on taxes. So on your 20 year history here, I think we can cut it down at least to the last 10. From there, though, you're going to want to go through this process of filing these returns the best you can, even if it's, I think you got to do the best you can.
Well,
go ahead.
Yeah, let me add something here. Matt, first, hit it right on the nail on the head. He's exactly right. Generally, the IRS is not going to come after you for more than 10 years of back taxes. And they can audit you back up to 10 years, frankly, if you've been evading them and they feel that you have. So the general rule is 6 years for an audit look back. But anyway, the point is, Matt's on it. 10-year look back is generally what you're going to be exposed to. But here would be my technique. This is like playing poker, want to be careful, be cautious here. I'm thinking of Brad Pitt, Ocean's 11. He's just kind of...
In other words, what Mark's saying here is this strategy is not ironclad. You can lose all your chips here.
This is an art,
This is Mark's disclaimer.
Yeah, you're dealing with the IRS. It's an art. And so here's, and I just, because a lot of people say I look like Brad Pitt, I had to kind of make a Ocean's 11 reference, to the poker game.
That was appropriate. Yeah,
thank you.
I'm more to George Clooney, but whatever.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I mean, this is the scene. George Clooney walks in, Brad Pitt's given poker lessons, So here's the poker game lesson here. This is very important. If you haven't filed tax returns for a bunch of years, and we're assuming the IRS is not sending you nasty letters right now, so for all they know, you don't even exist. You've kind of just fallen off their radar. But you want to get legit. You live in this country. You should pay your taxes. It does kind of piss me off a little. You need to pay your fair share. You're driving on the road. You get wonderful benefits living in this country. Pay your taxes. You should. And you also want to build your credit. You might want to get a loan and get, on the records of the United States so that you can operate generally as a normal American citizen. So file your taxes. But if the IRS isn't breathing down your neck right now, and they don't even know you're out there, I would just file your tax return. Just file this year. Just file it. File next year. File the year after. If all of a sudden you're paying your taxes and you're legit, and the IRS decides to go back and look at your prior 10 years, then let's talk. Let's go file those 10 years. If any of you are in that situation that you need to, I love the website priortax.com, www.priortax.com. You can start gathering data. You can ask for transcripts from the IRS so you know what they already know about you. Start there and start prepping these prior 10 years. But I wouldn't rush out and prep the 10 years unless they ask for it. Just start filing your returns and try to get legit. And there's a chance they won't even ask. You know, the IRS is a big behemoth. Do not think they're smarter than they are. So that's the way I'd go.
Let me say this too, Eddie. If you've been getting nasty letters from the IRS,
yes,
and you're already on their radar, this is not the strategy necessarily, because they will not go away.
Right. Yeah, they're not going to go away. Yeah.
So but I like that. That's a good. I like that. I like where you went there.
Well, thank you. The IRS is another important thing. If any of you are getting notices from the IRS, I just gave a quote to a newspaper this morning on this. People said, you know, what should I do if I get audited and this and that? If the IRS is sending any of you nasty grams, people, respond. The IRS is like a boyfriend or girlfriend that you went out on this great date and then you didn't call them. They're going to assume the worst. They're not going to be happy. And if you ignore the IRS's, you know, phone calls and letters, they're not going to call you, by the way. That's just an analogy. The IRS only sends paper. If you get a phone call from the IRS, it's a scam. We've talked about that on the show repeatedly. But if the IRS is sending you letters, reach out. Find out what's going on. Talk to them. If you start ignoring the IRS, that's when they really get pissed, and then things get ugly. So,
all right, cool. Now, I had this general question, which I thought was really good, that I got from Pablo in Texas about setting up an entity and choosing the best structure for your entity. And I want to kind of try and break this question down on the questions he asked, kind of like it was the when, what, where type questions for setting up your entity for your business. So Mark, if I'm just going to give Pablo's question here, and let's just dissect this and break it down a little bit for everyone, because this is one of the most common questions we get in our office. And guys, we set up entities nationwide for clients. We set up between 125 to 150 entities a month for clients, so we're definitely in the trenches, know our stuff in this area, and can certainly help you. But here's some kind of entry-level questions I think everybody needs to consider when they're setting up an entity, and this really gets to Pablo's question here.
Okay, love it. All right,
now here's Pablo. He just breaks it down. He says, basically, when should I set up my entity for my business? What state, where, I guess, let's call it the where, should I set up my entity? And what type of entity should I establish? Now, really, when I think about it, those are the three things you got to know. I mean, that's when it boils down to it, that's really the crux of what you should be thinking about when setting up an entity for your business. So let me hit the first one maybe about when, and then Mark, I'll let you comment on the other two if you like. You know,
okay,
whatever.
Yes, sir.
Do some banter back and forth, a little volley, if you will. All right, when. Now, when you think about setting up any type of business, whether you're an operating business, you're selling product online, you got a storefront, you've got a service, you have a real estate investment or project or a rental property, I don't care what it is. There's two things to think about: protecting yourself from liability of the business. That determines when to set it up. Are you going to have liability? And then the second question is this entity going to save me taxes? Now, on the liability side, you want to look at your business and say, all right, by what I'm doing now, does that cause liability? Could I get sued for what I'm doing? The easiest would be a rental property. You own a rental property, you've got tenants in there, sorry, but you've got some liability. So in that scenario, we want to try and set up an entity when you have the rental, because we want to protect your assets, all your other assets, from any liability that could happen in the rental. Let's say you're providing services, or you're an operating business, a store, whatever it may be. You may have customer issues or vendor problems, or you know, numerous issues that could come up where you have a liability. Well, you may want an entity in that type of scenario, whether it's a corporation or an LLC, doesn't matter, that protects, again, you personally from the liability of the business. So when to set it up, if you're going to have liability, that's the time to set up the entity, just for liability purposes. We're not even talking taxes yet, but just for liability purposes. If you're going to have liability, that's the time to set up the entity, get the protection now.
Yes, and I want to just add to, it's regrettable, folks. I know some of you just swear under your breath that, why do I have to go to this, you know, through this process? But we're in a litigious world now, lawsuits are very prevalent. If anybody gets coughed on the wrong way or looked at the wrong way or called the wrong name, there's a potential for a lawsuit. And that's not even to bring up the fact there might be injuries or an accident involved or in and around your business. So getting an entity is just good insurance. Chalk it up to that. Think of it as a tax deduction. And it's just a necessary evil of doing business in today's world. But we're in a great country. We're able to have capitalism and freedom to start our own business. There's just a little cost to doing it. So I like that, Matt, you point out, if anybody out there has a rental property or a business, and there's any exposure at all, that's a great time to at least consider an entity. Then it comes down to the type and where. Matt, which one should we go to next?
Yeah. Well, I just say one other thing of when to set it up is if you're an operating business where you're selling goods or services, not investment income like a rental property, but if you're an operating business selling goods or services and you're making more than $40,000 net income, we want to set up an entity simply for tax purposes there, because you're going to save on taxes by using an S-corporation. We've got a lot of prior shows and information on using the S-corporation and how you save taxes there, so check that out. But that's also a triggering point too, just in and of itself, is tax savings for operating businesses with at least $40,000 or more net income. All right, Mark, let's talk about the state. Why don't you touch on that if you want, about what state should you be setting it up in?
You bet. And there's some other questions, like Jordan had a question very similar to this, where he said, I'm just starting a business, and you know, how do I get started? What do I start to think about? And so, Jordan, we're kind of, this question of Pablo's, I know, is going to answer many of yours today. And I'm sending out little emails to those of you that had a question very similar to this, so that you hopefully we're knocking out several birds with one stone. Okay, where? I love to say this. First of all, you want to set up the entity where you're doing business. That's the general rule. Now, if you're an operational business, and I'm going to be doing a handyman service, I'm a realtor, I'm a contractor, I'm selling a product or service, and I live in a particular state, you're going to have your entity in that state. It's going to allow you to save taxes. You probably are going to have an S corporation in the mix, some payroll. Do not think that if you live in California or some state and go, well, I don't want to pay the $800, I'll just set it up in Nevada. Not going to fly. You're going to end up having penalties and interest. It's not going to work. So if you have an operational business, folks, you want to set it up in the state where you are doing business. Now, when it comes to rental property, it's a different set of criteria. If I live in Arizona, but I have a rental property in Arkansas, then I'm going to set up an Arkansas entity because I need the protection of doing business in Arkansas. That's where my rental is. That's where my tenant is. That's where my property manager is. That's where I'm doing business. Now, there are a few unique states like California that says, well, you're running your business out of California, even though it's in Arkansas, we want you to register here too. So they might snag you for what they call the franchise tax. But for 98% of you out there, you're going to set up rental property entities where the rental property is located. The final point on this is this COPE or asset protection strategy of, well, Mark, shouldn't I have a parent company? Why not use Wyoming or a Nevada or a Utah or an Alaska type entity that gives me even better protection? Well, if you've got maybe $1 million worth of real estate and 10 or so plus properties, we can add another layer of complexity and go to that cost of having an extra entity as a barrier. But we're not going to recommend that for a brand new investor. And if someone listening to the show is getting sold that, especially if they're trying to sell you in Nevada or some other location, freaking get out of there. You're with the wrong group. Get a second opinion, and we'd like to warn you. So that's kind of the where issue in a nutshell.
Yeah. God, well said. And I just want to say on that COPE structure or the charging order protection entity, we want to be careful there. I want people to realize that that is kind of a big boy structure. You know, if you're just starting out in business, you got your first operating business or your first property investment, whatever it may be, you probably don't need to jump down that route. Unfortunately, a lot of these places Mark mentioned that, you know, try and sell you a, you know, this elaborate package, they're going to try and push that down. You don't need that. But if you know you got $1 million of assets, or you got some specific liabilities you're concerned about, something like that, we want to look at maybe using that charging order protection entity as kind of the holding company in the middle there. All right. Last question here that sums this last question up, and this is a big one. So what is the right type of business for my entity? And the primary options you're going to have, what we are typically going to recommend for most small business owners is an S corporation for operating businesses, again, like selling goods or services, and LLCs for rental properties, investments, or partnership situations. Now, there's a lot of variation within there. Sure, you can have LLCs taxed as S-Corps. Sure, you can have series LLCs if you've got multiple properties in states that allow for series LLCs. But a few things we're not going to typically recommend is going to be a C-Corporation. You're generally not going to be looking at a C-Corporation if you're a small business. The double taxation there, even with the lower corporate tax rates now of 21%, is still not worth it. You're still going to overpay taxes than the other structures, so why pick it? You're going to pay more to the IRS. It's usually not something people want to volunteer. So, again, boiling down, S-Corp for operating businesses, LLCs for investments, rental properties, partnership scenarios.
Okay. I love it, Matt. Good stuff.
All right.
Okay.
Back to you in the studio.
Yes, back to you in the studio. Okay, Matt, this is a good question for you. This is from Andy. He says, what company do you recommend to go with as a custodian for a self-directed IRA? I have struggled finding and deciding on who to go with and wanted some direction recommendations on reputable companies that fit well within the Renatus program, which is a real estate online education program. Mm-hmm. Matt and I fully support it. We think they do a great job. Bob Snyder over there. But for anybody, Matt, mm-hmm. I'll just say that, for anybody that wants to self-direct an IRA, what do you recommend as by way of custodians?
There's plenty of them out there. I mean, with respect to Renatus or any real estate investors, most self-directed IRA custodians, they go after the real estate market. They want real estate investors. That's the most common self-directed IRA asset out there is real estate itself, or IRAs investing in LLCs that then buy real estate. So, you got a lot of options there. Let us know if you need some specific referrals, though. Or if you just want to check a company, you're like, hey, I've been thinking about using this company. What do you think? I mean, we'll give you our honest opinion.
Yeah. I think bottom line is that if you need a list of 2, 3, 4 options, email us privately. We'll send you a list, and we'll help you get with the right custodian that's affordable and simple for what you're trying to do. But, lots of options out there. Okay. Now, this is a question from Michael, another tax professional, and his question is really good. Oh, I said Michael. This is Michelle. I apologize. It was her signature is in cursive, and so I just had a Freudian slip and went straight to Michael instead of Michelle. So Michelle says, I have a client with a bakery. Now, this is a really good question for a lot of listeners. She says, I have a client with a bakery. They're going to open a second location and then a third location. We're already in the process, and we started another S-Corp, but we have location 3 and 4. What should we do? Okay, Michelle, stop, drop, and roll. Quit setting up S-Corporations like they're, you know, the next best thing to slice bread. Get it? Bakery, slice bread, man.
Boom. Dang, you just...
Boom! Well.
All right, that's the show for today. Thanks for listening, everyone.
Okay, thanks, everybody. all right, so Michelle, here's what we do with clients that have multiple locations but common ownership. So the owners aren't changing. They just have multiple locations. We set up a parent S corporation, and each location becomes their own LLC. Now, each location, if you want to have separate liability, you're going to make sure that each location has, and you mentioned, she mentions this in her question, that one of the locations has its own employees, no shared employees. Some of these locations may have their own payroll service, their own billing accounts, and all this. So they really operate like an isolated location. And then their books, though, are combined into this parent S corporation. So let me repeat this again for everybody. Have a parent S corporation where you report all the profit from these 3 or 4 locations of your business, but each individual location for asset protection has its own LLC, a wholly owned subsidiary, and they have their own checkbook and merchant account and tax ID number and employees. Now, some may say, Mark, are you crazy? I've got to do payroll for 4 different locations. when clients have multiple entities like this, a lot of times they set up an entity just for payroll, and you do kind of a payroll leasing sister company, and this hires all your employees across the board so that you have uniform fringe benefits and healthcare benefits, employee handbooks, employee manuals, and procedures, and then you lease the employees to the different locations, and that can be a good fit. So there's different ways to go after it, but the bottom line here is I try to keep everything consolidated from a reporting standpoint for taxes into one big S corporation. It's going to make life easier for the business owners, for exit strategies, and then try to isolate each location for protection. That would be the way I'd go, Michelle.
Love it. Okay. You know, I just did that structure probably 2 months ago with some clients that own some bars and restaurants in the Midwest, and they were already operating out of all these other entities. They had one with a partnership and other locations that they owned wholly, and they were all in separate entities, and they owned the buildings too, and it was a mess. And that's what we did. We dropped it all down into one S corp that owned each of these LLCs that owned the respective restaurant. We also moved the buildings out too, by the way. So that's just another note. If you have, let's say you own the location and you operate the business out of there, we don't want that in the same entity. We don't want your operating business, let's say the bakery or bar and restaurant, to be in the same entity that also owns the building. We want to separate that building out into its own LLC because it's an asset. It's an investment now. Let it lease the property to your operating company that pays it rent and separate those two out. So love that. A lot of good planning opportunities there, but also some ways to mess it up. So
yeah, no, it's crazy. Okay, Matt, I got a question for you.
Yes.
This is from Letitia, and she says, how can I undo a mistake? This goes right with the last question you posed, Matt. How can I undo a mistake I made when I fell for the scam of the Nevada Corporation? I have two different LLCs, one for my regular small retail business and the other for real estate, but I haven't made any money on the real estate. Now I have to file 5 different tax returns according to my tax preparer and file an extension since LLCs are filed by tomorrow. Now this was for the last show before the filing deadline. I hope, Letitia, for your sake, that you all you did was file extensions. And it's so hard. I feel bad that we didn't see this question before now, but hopefully you just filed extensions. She said they are going to charge me $1,500 to prepare all 5 returns. Is that even true that I have to do 5? I'll comment on the tax returns maybe, Matt, mm-hmm. but what do you recommend when someone says, I've got 2 LLCs in Nevada now, and I don't even live in Nevada? What would you say for that?
Well, a lot of times clients will come to us with a business structure and we'll kind of modify it, maybe clean it up, so to speak. You know, a lot of times in our office, we call it the Legal Zoom cleanup. You know, a lot of clients set it up on Legal Zoom and it's kind of like halfway done and they need the rest done or they need something fixed. So we're doing one of those probably on a daily basis. So if you got one of those, let us know. We can kind of clean it up and get it set up to optimize really for your business and what you're doing. But a lot of times, like this scenario, you know, as I learned out on the ranch, you just can't polish a turd, Mark. You just can't.
Out on the ranch. All right. This go back to my saloon comment. I didn't know you were going to the ranch in Phoenix. All right, fair enough.
Yeah. And by the ranch, I mean the McCormick Ranch golf course in Scottsdale.
Okay. That's there what you I go. Meant. Okay, fair enough.
Yeah. But it is true, folks. You just can't polish a turd. Sometimes it's better to just throw it away and start over. And that's what I would do with this Nevada entity. What I would do, dissolve it, shut it down sooner than later. Nevada has an annual, you know, master business license nonsense fee that they charge to really make money out of state people because Nevada's broke too. So, or at least they were. And so, you know, that was like a $400 to $500 annual fee, almost competing with California on annual fees. So, plus you're getting all this tax reporting you're needing. I would just dissolve those entities, both of them. Even the one that had some activity, and start out 2018 as soon as you can with the new entity in the state you're actually operating out of. And the sooner you do that, the less tax returns you're going to have here and headache that you're dealing with now, and the less fees you're going to be paying to the state. The hard thing is it takes some money to dissolve it and shut it down. So sometimes it's like, oh, I got to pay more money. but it's going to save you the next time, next year around this time of year, where you're going to have to be paying all these tax return fees and paying the state for all your renewals.
Yeah, it's going to pay off in the long run. And so just hang in there. And now, Letitia, here's on the tax issue. When they say five tax returns, but you say you only have two LLCs, something's weird. They might be saying two business returns, your personal return, and maybe two state returns. And so they're kind of throwing the state into this. What I'm hoping is you filed extensions. Folks, one of the things I would say to any of you, and especially Letitia, is that if you haven't made a lot of money yet on this, I would change the LLC structure retroactively. You can just file an internal document and make it a single member LLC. That way you can just report it on your individual 1040, Schedule C or Schedule E. That's going to save you some money. And undo the original documentation if it's a two-member LLC down to a single-member LLC, and then get with our paralegals, like Matt said, and look at articles of domestication, dissolution. Just get these things freaking out of Nevada and save that money moving forward. So if we got to you in time, if this message got to you in time, and Letitia, then I think there's a couple things you could do to save some money on that process. So hopefully that's the case. Bless your heart. Matt, I got a question from you. This is from Bill, a regular listener of ours, a great client and contact. He knows who he is. And he says, I was just attended a Saturday education event with one of the largest IRA custodians in the United States. They do not support the owner of an IRA being the manager of a checkbook IRA LLC and suggest using a non-disqualified third party as the manager. I'd like to hear the dynamic duo, Mark and Matt, and their thoughts on this matter. Second area of concerns relates to subsequent investments into a checkbook IRA LLC. Well, Bill, what do you want? World peace too? Geez, that second question, that there's, you know... that's a big one. But let's just deal with the first one. I'm already starting an email to him saying they are full of crap. But Matt, why don't you give them the real rules on this, the author of the book, Self-Directed IRA Handbook.
Yes. So I have a whole chapter in my book specifically on this question too. So keep in mind the detail, the case citations, the IRS pronouncements, revenue rulings, it's all in there. There's probably, I'd say, 25 self-directed IRA custodians out there in the industry right now, and I would say five of them don't allow you to do an IRA LLC where you're the manager of the IRA LLC. And a lot of them, this has been their policy for 10, 20 years. They've just always said that, and they've always had a legal issue with it or a policy issue. And there's some underlying business issues there, frankly. They want your money basically still in their account, not in an LLC bank account. But they have had some legal concerns, and they haven't, frankly, updated their policies over the years. So whereas the case law and the IRS pronouncements, revenue rulings have shown that you can be manager of an LLC as long as it's structured properly and you're operating it properly, we follow the cases on this and certainly anything of interest on the subject. So it's certainly possible. You just got to do it right. There are companies that do disagree, but most of the companies in the industry allow for it so long as it's set up properly and then operated properly.
Well, excellent comment, Matt. Now, I will just say this, Bill, on additional contributions to an IRA LLC, that is more complicated. I would probably recommend a consult with the attorney setting up your IRA LLC. There are some ways to do it. It's not generally recommended because clients will screw it up and some custodians start scratching their head. What do you mean you're putting more money in this? What's going on? So if you use the right type of custodian and the right type of documents, you can do it. I will just say in general, it has to be a pro rata contribution, meaning if one member of the LLC is going to put in money, all the members do based on the contribution amount and their pro rata ownership share. So that's just a general answer. Matt, would you endorse that answer?
Yeah. And some of the custodians used to at least require a letter when you had this kind of partnership scenario with additional investment money coming from the IRA or IRAs, you know, in a partnership scenario. and it had to be pro rata. We used to write those letters when needed. That's kind of fallen by the wayside. Most of them kind of accepted it now that allow for the IRA LLC. What's certainly clear, and there's a DOL opinion, by the way, on this that's in my book on my partnership LLC chapter. In the 100% owned scenario where you have your IRA own an LLC 100%, you want to invest more money from the IRA to the LLC after you set it up, that's fine. The money goes to the IRA. The IRA invests the additional money. There is a DOL opinion on that specifically as well. So usually you should be fine in getting that. I will say, you know, when I started learning about this in 2006, there was a lot more questions on this. And these questions were the type of questions we would get in 2006. Now, 12 years later, I don't really get these much from most of the companies in the industry anymore or get these issues raised. It seems to kind of be settled. But there are some companies out there still kind of, frankly, back living in 2006, you know, listening to who was popular in 2006. I don't know. Some crappy music in 2006 that no one listens to now. Nickelback. I don't know.
Oh, man. Jeez.
They weren't even good then, though.
They just took a shot. All right. Jeez. Well, since you do know how to play the guitar, I will allow any disparaging remarks about another band just because you had a band.
That's right.
It's legit. Matt has performed on stage with a guitar sliding across the stage on his back, you know, and just rocking out. If you've seen Back to the Future, that's Matt Sorensen right there. So,
that's right.
Okay. So if he wants to throw down on Nickelback, I'll allow him that leeway. Okay. Now, we got another question here from Jordan. This is different Jordan. He says, now I got it. This is a tough question, but I'm going to throw it out there because he freaking gives us some love here. He says, very quickly, I love the show, not only for the information, but also hear you guys make fun of each other and laugh at yourselves. Mostly the show is me making fun of Matt, but anyway, Jordan, that's okay. He says, it's great. The movie.
That's what I look forward to also, just so you know.
Yep. Matt's self-esteem takes a hit every week. Yeah, it's good for him. Everybody pumps him up during the week. I bring him down to reality during the show. He says, it's great. The movie quotes and references are right up my alley, too. Obviously, he's a fan of the 80s genre. I came across the show in February, and I've listened to a year's worth of podcasts in just the last 5 weeks. Thanks so much, Jordan. And I know we've got some dedicated listeners out there, and we love you. We appreciate it. We try to bring our game every week. Okay, so he says, okay, now this is tricky, everybody. We're going to throw down for some of you high-end listeners. He says, I have an S-Corp for my operations. Rental management of my own rentals, wholesaling, and flipping properties. Okay, cool. I usually don't have... Yeah, I can live with that. I can live with that. I also have an LLC structure with a parent company that owns the LLCs that own the homes. All right? So he's got an elaborate asset protection structure on the right. He's got a parent LLC owning baby LLCs. The S-Corp is in Illinois where the operations are. The parent LLC is in Wyoming, and the subsidiary LLCs are in Utah, and the properties are in Illinois. This was the structure set up by a guru 4 years ago. What am I doing wrong with the LLC structure? Well, a couple comments. First, as long as your Utah LLCs that own the properties, as long as those LLCs are registered foreign in Illinois, which I assume they are. So assuming that that little piece is taken care of, so he has a Wyoming LLC that owns this Utah LLC, and then the Utah LLCs are on title, and the LLCs are registered to do business in Illinois, I will say this, Jordan, I think it's a pretty freaking awesome structure. My only concern is, do you really have the income and operations and wealth to support it? This is the Cadillac, people. He is driving down the... Does anybody drive a Cadillac anymore? Let me go. Millennials. This is the McLaren. This is
the Tesla.
See, I can throw down with the millennials. This is the McLaren of tax and legal planning. And I don't know if your properties are more of kind of a Kia. I don't know if you're more of a Kia structure or more of a McLaren structure. You're paying for the McLaren. You better be driving 120 miles an hour at night, 1 a.m. when no one's around. But if you're really dealing with a Kia property structure, then your legal structure is way, way too much for you. But I love it. I don't have a problem with it. Matt, do you agree? And how did you appreciate that analogy?
I agree. I appreciate that. You know, you're just hitting everybody. You know, the Cadillac lovers, the McLarens. I mean, crap. What the heck is a McLaren? That's like...
Don't say that. You're going to insult yourself there.
I kind of... is this like some European car? I don't know. I don't know. I'm just I'm a Porsche fan myself. So if it's, I mean, I don't know, was McLaren better than a Porsche?
A little bit, but that's okay. If you've been to a car show, you watch the Vegas car. These, yeah, you're a couple hundred grand just to, you know.
Okay, I have heard of it. I just can't picture it. I thought it was like a part of Ferrari, actually. I don't know.
Yeah, they're pretty cool.
Okay.
My son and his buddies geek out on them. So, okay, but anyway, so you're okay with the structure, right?
Yep. I totally agree with exactly what you said. And that's, you know, when we're consulting with the client and setting it up, we want, you know, we want to get you in the right car, you know?
Ooh, good call.
We want to get the car that fits your budget, you know? So,
thank you, Remax.
Some of these used car salesmen you go to set up these entities, they're going to sell you the biggest, you know, the most expensive car on the lot. That's not us at KQS Lawyers. You know, we're going to get you in the right car.
That's right. You know what I mean? Yep. Totally. And now he does have a follow-up here. He says, hopefully that's helpful for everyone. And then he says, if I buy the properties in my S-Corp in the case of a flip, but end up keeping it as a rental, are there tax ramifications for selling the property my LLC? Should I sell it for a profit to myself or deed it over? Whew. Okay, now you got your accountant in the mix, and you do not want to sell a property from your S-Corp to your LLC. Don't do that. And you want to deed it over to your LLC if you're going to decide to keep it as a rental. But timing is critical, Jordan, because there is what's called a built-in gains tax, that if you work on this flip and now it's worth more and then you deed it to your LLC, you're theoretically supposed to pay the tax as if you did sell it to your LLC. And we don't want that. So what I tell clients is you want to do it in the same tax year as soon as possible. Get it off the books of the S-Corp if you know it's going to be a rental, and just deed it over to the LLC that's going to be the holding company. If you keep it and report it on the books of an S-Corp and then the next year try to take it off the books, that's when the IRS goes, whoa, whoa, whoa. What'd you do? Why'd you do that? And they're going to ask questions. So make sure your accountant's in the mix before you start just deeding properties like crazy. Okay, man, I've got a good question here. Let me see. Matt, may I pose you one here?
Absolutely.
Okay, this is a 1099 question, so let's just throw it out there. He says, this is Victoria. She says, do real estate investors need to submit 1099s for payments totaling over $600 made to contractors for the year, or are we exempt? I own mobile home parks and have contractors for lawn mowing, rehab, and old trailers. I'm also a California resident, but in my mobile home park's in Ohio. I understand I have to pay the California LLC stupid $800 tax. That was her word, not mine. And so
California Matt, Franchise first, Tax Board, that was a quote, okay?
That was a quote. Yeah. She says, Matt, just give her the rundown. I mean, she obviously needs to learn about this I-9 stuff. And go ahead.
Yeah. So on the 1099s, operating a mobile home park, yeah, my sense is you're going to need to send those out, obviously over $600. So unfortunately, you're going to have to do some 1099 reporting. Now, this is a question I actually had, Mark, that you could maybe clarify, because this has been on the show before, and I've even had some differences of opinion of what constitutes a trade or business, because the 1099 requirement says you must be in a, you know, if you have a trade or business, you need to send a 1099. But is my rental property specifically a trade or business? And that's, I think, kind of the gray area where I think people get tripped up, and maybe where Victoria's tripped up on, and where I'm deferring to the CPA here to give the final answer for. This is like my phone is CPA for my own answer here.
Well, I will say this.
Don't make me answer a 1099 question. Jeez.
Yeah. I'm sorry. I'm just throwing it out there. We've got questions all over the board. She says, I would say this. You need to remember that even owning a rental property is a trader business, and if you pay contractors, you need to issue a 1099 if you're required to. Now, but you are a trader business. What they're trying to help people know is that if you're a homeowner, like you're just your own home, and you hire someone to come work on your own house, you don't have to issue a 1099. It's only if you're in a trader business like owning rental property or a standard business. The key here, though, is get a W-9, Victoria, before anybody gets a paycheck. Sorry, not a paycheck. Before anybody gets a check from you for doing anything, you need to get a W-9 from them and say, who are you? Because a lot of these folks are going to want to get paid under the table. You don't want to get into that game. It can hurt you from a liability standpoint. It can hurt you from a tax standpoint. Just get W-9s from everyone and say, either you work for me and here I need a W-9 or you don't. And some people will walk away. And you know what? Those are contractors you don't want anyway. Mm-hmm. So just stay legit.
Now, I got a question for you, Mark. You ready?
Yes. Oh, sure.
Okay. All right.
Matt, I got a question for you. It's another tax one. I'm sorry. I'm just combing here through her IRA questions, but I'm just going to throw it at you. This is Amanda. She says, can you review what can be written off as maintenance and repairs? I have a few rental properties. I purchased new windows, water heaters, furnace, painted, purchased appliances, repiped, etc. Not sure what I can write off. Hmm. I travel from California, Arizona once a month to tend to my properties. So, Matt, since you live in Arizona, I know you have properties in other states. Yeah. When you're doing this, what do you do?
I think the travel's easier. You want to that travel definitely take as an expense to go visit the property. That's easier. And but in terms of the maintenance and repair questions you're throwing there, those items that you were rattling off there, the water heater, the windows, stuff like that, appliances, that doesn't sound like maintenance and repairs to me. Okay, I think maintenance and repairs are more like light bulbs, filters, cleaning. Maybe some touch-up paint type stuff. That's more maintenance and repairs. So unfortunately, I think on most of those items you were rattling off there, windows, water heater, I can't remember some of the others, but those are things you're going to have to capitalize and expense over time. But you may take those. Some of those might be 5 years. You could expense them over 5 years, but you're going to have to depreciate those and essentially take some of those over time. But definitely the travel you can expense. I just don't see the items you were rattling off there is falling into maintenance and repairs, unfortunately.
Yep. And we, as an accounting firm, we have a little schedule that we train all of our new accountants on what falls into an improvement that you depreciate and what falls into a repair or maintenance. If you're preparing your own tax return and you've got a rental property and you don't know these rules, it's going to be a little more precarious. This is when maybe it's time to graduate from Tax Slayer or Tax or TurboTax and start using a professional for your tax return. So be cautious there, Amanda. Okay, this is from Anna. She throws out, I love Anna. She's just, you know, maybe she thinks we're amazing or she's just a little greedy, but, you know, bless her heart. She goes, please address some of these issues on your next show. she says, for those of us who are already retired or on Social Security, so we got a unique category there, okay, where certain answers would only apply to them. But she goes, how much, you're going to love this, how much can we earn in a sole proprietor without triggering taxes on Social Security? Can we open a new IRA or 401k in our business? What health plans can we use? Are some entities better for us than others? Can we buy whole life insurance? well, bless your heart, Anna. Anything else? No, I love it. Matt, let's just take one of those. And Anna, this is a good reason for a consultation. When you've got 5 or 10 questions, you're concerned about your situation moving forward, and you don't have a good tax or legal advisor, these are questions that we would cover in a half hour to an hour and rock your world. You would love it. So,
What I was just going to say is really there's not a lot of differences. And a lot of the consulting and advice I'm going to give to someone who may be in their 60s is similar to someone in their 40s. And we do have clients who are business owners starting out even that may be in their 60s, maybe they're on Social Security, those are even over 70. There's a couple things you need to know about, such as Social Security, retirement plan contributions, and you may be at a certain age where you're not making retirement plan contributions or not able to once you're at 70 and a half. But I think a lot of your planning is going to be similar, but you do need to learn a couple additional things, and I think she's hitting you know, the topics here, which are how's your Social Security going to get treated, and also healthcare, because you have the Medicare now that you could be qualifying for that, you know, a lot of other people who aren't at least in that age bracket aren't going to qualify for. But you know, this depends on your spouse's age too, and what does your spouse have, what benefits do you have with them already. There's a lot of parts here we'd want to bring in to give you some kind of better answers, unfortunately. I don't know I can generalize any advice, frankly.
Yeah. And Anna, the one thing I'd say, when I'll be a little specific on one of them, is you said, can we open new IRAs or 401ks? And you are right. If you're on Social Security, your health plan options are going to be a little more limited. You may not qualify for an HSA. You're going to already be on Medicare, possibly. I'm not sure how old you are. You know, health planning is going to be a little trickier, but can we open new IRAs and 401ks in our business? And I want to agree with Matt, absolutely. If you're over age 60 and you're still doing business, which many, many people are, I mean, 60 is the new 50, right? So you're out there doing business. I have consultations with clients in their 70s at times, and they're opening Roth IRAs, and they're making their grandkids beneficiaries, and they're funding their 401k, and so you can do those. Now, is it in your best interest? It depends on your makeup. You know, what's your financial situation? And but you can open them. It's just, should you open them? Okay, Matt, yeah. Let me field this one. This is from Matt.
Well, this is going to be last question, I think.
You want to do it? Last question? All right. This is Matt, M-A-T-T.
Okay.
Just clarifying that so you don't get, you know.
Good for him. You got two T's in there. Seems a little excessive to me, but whatever.
Yeah, this is one T, Matt, you know, giving his take on that. Okay, now, so would you recommend putting real estate investment properties once purchased into a real estate trust with the beneficiary being an S-Corp or LLC? I have read that up until the new tax law, this was the way to go, but the new tax law changes it, but I can't find out why. Thanks for your advice. Hmm. Well, Matt, I don't know if I can agree with the way to go before the new tax law. I have a whole chapter in my book, The Tax and Legal Playbook, titled Land Trust, Savior or Snake Oil. I generally believe they are snake oil. Land trusts are oversold. I don't think you need them to hold real estate. You might create a little privacy or anonymity, and that's it. You do not save taxes with the land trust. You do not get better asset protection with the land trust. And if the beneficiary is your S-Corp because you're flipping, or it's an LLC because it's a rental, that's fine. Who cares? The real asset protection is at the LLC, and the tax planning is at the S-Corp level. I think land trusts might be helpful in buying and selling properties with seasoning and subject to deals, but that's cool. If you're not doing that, what the hell are you doing with a real estate trust? I'm not a fan. And by the way, the new tax law has nothing to do with this. So I don't see, if you were using land trust before, the new tax law isn't going to make them better or worse. I was a little adamant there, Matt. Sorry about that. So
no, I was gonna go a little more hardcore than you did. So I'm glad you showed a little restraint,
tenacity.
I thought you held back. We just talk a lot of people out of them, if you can't tell. So we just have not found them to be a great fit, so we talk a lot of people out of them. All right, well, I wanted to just give one last plug, and I don't know how much longer we're going to do this and ask for 5-star reviews, but I want to say thanks for all of you who have been giving us 5-star reviews on wherever you're finding our podcast. Mark and I have been offering a free copy of Mark's latest book, The Business Owner's Guide to Financial Freedom, or my book, The Self-Directed IRA Handbook. And it's free. We ship it to you. You just got to let us know where you gave the review. But we're still doing that for now. We might do away with that at one point. But I want to read a couple of reviews that we had come in, if you don't mind, Mark. I mean, just, you know, just give a little shout out to those giving us 5-star reviews. So this was from Rackets. It said, business owners must subscribe. 5-star review. If you're a business owner, you need to subscribe to this podcast. The knowledge and insight Mark and Matt bring will reap you triple dollar signs and time. Also, there was Best of the Best, 5-star review from Jay, says Mark and Matt are two of the top professionals in their field, engaging, informative, and down-to-earth, breaking down complex business and investment strategies to help us all be more successful. So thanks so much for those that have gotten onto iTunes or Stitcher or wherever you're finding our podcasts and giving us a 5-star review. It really helps the show on those channels, and it helps other people find it. So thanks for taking the time out to do that.
Yeah. Thank you, everybody, for listening this week. Your homework, okay, this week is, yep, we're going to give homework, Lincoln Lawyer. I'm a Matthew McConaughey fan. I have a man crush on him. If we can get him on the show to talk about his experiences playing a lawyer, he's done some John Grisham, and he knows what he's doing. So yeah. I just want to give him a shout out.
He was a Time to Kill, right?
Yeah, I think Time to Kill. Yeah, he's awesome. So, folks, that's your homework. We will be giving you movies to watch that will help improve you as a legal connoisseur. So anyway, thanks everybody for listening. We have so much fun here with you. It's an honor to be a part of your lives, and we're just trying to eke it out a living with our American dream as well. And I wish you all the best, and we'll see you next week for another round of Refresh Your Wealth.
Thanks for listening to another hour of refreshing strategies to better live your American dream.
Don't forget to get your free copy of Mark and Matt's ebooks and sign up for their weekly free newsletter with important tax deadlines and articles at refreshyourwealth.com.